Hello everyone, Stan Gill here. Welcome to the Hollywood South Blacklist. This is show number 2 and was originally recorded on Friday, September 14th, 2012. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com and be sure to stop by the website to take a look around. Enjoy. Well, hello everybody, Stan Gill here, and this is the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. So, what I have lined up for this show, we'll talk about the Film and Television Tax Incentive Program in Alaska. Digital Domain, the big effects visual house, has filed for bankruptcy. Fast Company did a story on Big Easy Startups, and I'll roll that into how it helped film and television tax incentives helped other industries like digital media and game producers, things like that. We have the NOLA Film Festival coming up in October. There's a NOLA Bounds documentary screening, which I'll get into. And we'll talk a little bit about the indie film scene in New Orleans. What's wrong with it? What's not there? What's there? And just to open up the discussion about that. Alaska has a film and television tax incentive program similar to Louisiana, and they have apparently issued their second largest filming incentive payment to a serial killer drama called Frozen Ground. Now, I've never been to Alaska, but anytime you see pictures or documentaries shot up there, it's absolutely beautiful. And it was shot in the second half. That film was shot in the second half of 2011. They were awarded just over $6 million after spending $20 million locally in the economy to get that film done. Now, earlier in the year, Alaska had extended its incentive program for 10 years and committed some $200 million, but it's still having a problem attracting what they call big-budget Hollywood films. And California has that same issue. They have extended their program for another 2 years, and I think $200 million, and they're trying to keep productions from running away, going to states like Louisiana and other states where they really don't have to put up with too much hassle, especially from local politicians, things like that. Now, the big problem that Alaska has had is what Louisiana encountered early in their program is that they have low crew levels. Alaska, it must be a beautiful state because I always see these documentaries that have great, beautiful scenic views of it. But the population up there doesn't have too many people who work in the film and television industry. And from what I understand, a lot of people come over from British Columbia, crew talent that is, to go work in Alaska. It's a little bit of a hump, if you will, to get up to Alaska and back and forth when you're trying to work on some of these productions. So I think Alaska's program is attractive. It's just if you're going to film and you need that kind of backdrop, I could see a production going up there. So we'll see. We'll see how long-term their incentive program lasts. And like I said, Alaska suffered from what Louisiana suffered from in the very beginning of its program, of low crew levels. Louisiana has picked up on that, and crew levels are slowly ticking up. In fact, a lot of people are moving to New Orleans, Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Shreveport, to take advantage of the industry that is growing at a breakneck speed, if you ask me. Digital Domain, the big visual effects house, has filed for bankruptcy. They're located in Venice, California, which is south of Santa Monica, west of downtown LA. But the big one was their animation studio located out at Port St. Lucie, Florida. They've laid off well over 300 employees and, for all intents and purposes, have practically shut the doors. Now, from what I understand in the bankruptcy filing, there's a skeletal crew there, and they're trying to continue pumping out some of these features that got locked up there. Apparently, Searchlight Capital Partners has offered to put up some money, about $15, $20 million, to try to keep them running until it gets to the point where they can sell off their assets. It's pretty sad all the way around, especially when over 300 people are losing their jobs. Now, Digital Domain was founded back in 1993 by James Cameron of Titanic fame. He had some partners and created the effects for Titanic recently as Tron Legacy and the Transformers films. Cameron sold that off. I can't remember when he sold that off, another group. And the current group that owns it or has filed bankruptcy on it is trying to figure out a way of trying to get it ready for a sale out of bankruptcy. I don't know what's going to come of that, but it's pretty sad when they went down to Florida and asked Florida for some tax incentives and some breaks and putting up a incubator studio, if you will, trying to help animation students down there learn the craft and use their work in paid assignments. And when I say paid assignments, meaning paid contracts where studios would come in and hire Digital Domain to do effects. Now, from what I understand, they were using, I'm not saying on everything, but using animation students and training them. In exchange for training them, their work product would be able to put out into these features. Personally and professionally, I have this long-standing dislike for internships. You're either going to hire somebody to do the job and pay them a decent rate, salary, whatever, to do the job, or you don't. In Hollywood, the internship, quote-unquote, gopher, free labor, slave labor, whatever you want to call it, is just absolutely rampant. In fact, next show, we're going to talk about a lawsuit, believe it or not, against Fox Entertainment from some interns that say that they were abused. We'll discuss that in the next podcast. I'm not sure what the internal workings that happened at Digital Domain, but from the external view, looking at it, they just got in way over their head. Some of the analysts that I have read have said that they just started expanding way too much. And it's sad because it could have been a good little industry down there. Now, I wish they would have come to Louisiana and worked out some kind of deal, but Louisiana no longer has these infrastructure tax credits. In Florida, they have a program that's similar to that, and without getting too deep into the woods, that the state worked with them on working with schools and getting some incentives down there. Now, some of the fallout from the Digital Domain bankruptcy, of course, is well over 300 people just basically were pink slipped and said, hey, don't come back to work. I picked up on this one story about this family, the Alberts family, and Erin Alberts, the wife, it's a husband, wife, and they've got a couple, three kids, and she got a job down at Digital Domain working as in their accounting department. So guess what? They packed up their house, sold all their belongings, got in their car, and drove to Florida, to Port St. Lucie, Florida. The sad part of it is just literally miles before they got off the off-ramp, they got a phone call from a relocation specialist because they had hired a relocation specialist to try to get them a place and get them settled in down there. And the relocation specialist said, hey, you didn't hear the news? And they said, what news? Well, Digital Domain just filed for bankruptcy and they just laid off over 300 people. Well, here's a family that picked up, and in this economy, it's pretty bad because jobs, there's well over 23 million people out of work. Here's somebody who's willing to pick up and go to a different state, and they get shafted because the company goes under, and now these people are without a job. And apparently in the story, they got all the way down there and then didn't have much money left, and now what do they have to do? They have to go back home, so... That's pretty sad if you ask me. Now, apparently, Florida state officials are investigating the company's use of millions of dollars in subsidies, including funds to develop a Digital Domain Institute, a partnership with Florida State University to teach digital arts. And that was a big part of Digital Domain setting up shop down there. Now, I don't necessarily have too much of a problem where if you're a college student and you're going to Florida State University and you're learning a digital art and a craft and some of your work output is actually ending up in a Hollywood film, because hey, that's great. That would go great on a resume that not only you're in college doing something to train and learn skills, but actually your work product is being put out for films that are being released, whether it's Transformers or Avatar or whatever it happens to be. And in that respect, I don't have any problem with that kind of arrangement or setup. Now, granted, this is Florida. They can do whatever they want to do. But now with the bankruptcy filing, I guarantee you the Florida state officials and the local officials are going to get involved and try to figure out, hey, was the money mismanaged? with the Digital Institute. Let's just hope that it was a bad deal all the way around. It was bad management. They just expanded too fast, too far, in my opinion. Granted, a lot of digital work that is done in films today is shipped overseas to companies that can set up hundreds of technicians to sit down at workstations and work for a lot less dollars per hour or even per week or per day to knock out some of the hardcore things when it comes to creating these special visual effects, things like that. In fact, I know a few people that have left the United States and gone to other countries, stayed there for a couple of months, being a creative director, technical director, whatever it happens to be, working on projects. So it was great to see Florida State, United States, keeping a digital art school, Digital Domain Institute over at Florida State University. But, you know, the company's bankrupt now. They're going to go in there and the creditors are going to start chomping away at what little meat is left on the bone. Now, one of the films that was done in Louisiana, Ender's Game, which was a Summit Entertainment Lionsgate film, Digital Domain was a co-producer on there, and the reason they were a co-producer is because they're doing a lot of visual effects on it. And right now, with Digital Domain in bankruptcy, Ender's Game theatrical release date and their domestic and foreign release dates are starting to be locked up. And you can't really change those dates unless something drastic happens. Now, I don't know. Can they turn around and claim against the insurance that the company went under? I don't know, because Digital Domain is one of the co-producers. But it's going to be very interesting. I understand that Lionsgate has gone in and said, listen, whatever happens, we need to get our work out of there, and it can't be shut down. We don't really care about anything else going on in there. We just need to get our film out. I can understand that. There was a lab, and I can't remember the name of the lab off the top of my head. I want to say it was Metro Lab, but I could be wrong. In Los Angeles, there was a film lab that went under, I don't know how many years ago, 15 plus years ago, where there were a bunch of films still in the lab and in the vaults. And the lab just, you know, they showed up one day and the creditors locked the doors, put padlocks on it, and shut the place down. Well, guess what? These film producers and studios had their films in there and they couldn't get to them without a court order. So what they had to do is they had to turn around, come up with a pool of money to actually pay the electricity and pay the employees to go back in, finish developing their films, whatever had to transpire, and then get all of their masters, their film negative out of there, the prints, any kind of effects shots that they had that were created there, and get them out and go to another lab. So I just hope in my career I never have to run into something like that or something with the Digital Domain closing up. And if I remember for next show, I'll come up with that lab that had closed. But you never know. And that's what I'm afraid of in Louisiana, where you have these boutique shops open up and you're a producer, you put your product in these boutique shops and something happens, your masters are in there and they go bankrupt or something happens and you can't get those masters back. I feel sorry for everybody involved. I feel more sorry for the people who lost their jobs. That definitely has got to be one big bummer. Okay, so let's get away from the depressing story and talk about something a little more upbeat. I read this article in Fast Company by Chris Johnson on September 11, 2012, entitled "The Big Easiest Place to Build a Startup." He goes on to talk about how the film and television tax incentives actually were a springboard for other tax incentives when it comes to digital media. So one of the original films, or one of the first films to take advantage of the film and television tax incentives in Louisiana, was Ray, the film with Jamie Foxx. Now, guess what? Jamie Foxx goes on to win Best Actor, and a lot of press and a lot of publication and marketing revolves around that film, and so stories are being created. It was shot in Louisiana. Oh, by the way, they have these film and television tax incentives. Come down here and shoot. And so that sort of opened up the doors more to the world to say, hey, bring your projects down to Louisiana and let's shoot there. Now, guess what? Because of that, the state started thinking, this is pretty good. We're actually bringing in more economic activity and bringing more revenue into the state. People are moving here. They're relocating. They're spending their money here instead of spending it in, say, living in Los Angeles and flying to Baton Rouge and staying there on location. So all these little digital startups started popping up. Turbo Squid, if I remember correctly, I think was the first one. There's Launchpad and a couple others that popped up that started taking advantage of the digital media tax incentives that Louisiana came up with. So if we go back to the summer of 2005, the Louisiana State Legislature had passed these tax credit structures for digital companies. And then a few months later, August 2005, Katrina hits, and a few weeks later, Rita hits, and the next thing you know is instead of business development kind of mentality, Louisiana, especially New Orleans, shifted into a survivability mentality. The way I look at it, and this is just my opinion, the way I saw it structured, because while I was not there during Katrina, I did get back to New Orleans in December 2005, just recently after they had opened up the Louis Armstrong International Airport for commercial traffic instead of relief traffic. But when I got down there and started looking around, trying to figure out, a lot of the film and television structure, if you will, independent community was sort of obliterated. Everybody went their separate way, much like the music industry. Musicians had left, took their instruments, and had to go elsewhere because at that time everybody was more concerned about survivability and trying to get by on a day-to-day basis. And what I saw happen was after a couple years had gone by and the city and the southeastern region of Louisiana had started to really recover from the Katrina and the levee breaking disasters, that the state legislature had now broadened the digital tax structure incentives to, instead of just a game and digital animation, which helped fuel entertainment on the film and television side, and also as far as mobile and console games, is they opened it up to include all digital media startups. Everything from 35% payroll costs to 25% of their non-payroll expenditures were the kinds of tax incentives that were created to help develop that. This is sort of unique because I think, and I'm going to use a bad pun here, but I think it was a perfect storm that had developed. One, the film and television tax incentives were passed and those were being used. And Ray comes to town, Jamie Foxx, well known, gets the Oscar. Next thing you know is productions started coming in and taking advantage of those opportunities. And Louisiana was the beneficiary of that economic revenue. You had more crew talent coming in. The next thing that happens is these digital tax credit structures are passed by the state legislature, Louisiana state legislature. A couple years goes past Katrina, now you're getting into 2007, 2008. Well, guess what? Towards the end of 2008, I think it was December 2008, was the official start of the Great Recession. And then we get into 2009, the digital tax incentives that were originally created got broadened in that session, 2009, 2010, I believe. All of a sudden, the unemployment rate just skyrockets. You have a lot of college students that are in Louisiana that can't go anyplace else. One of the problems that Louisiana has always had, and listen, I'm totally guilty of this because I went to LSU for a couple of years and transferred, came out to Los Angeles and went to a really fine film school, Columbia College of Hollywood, and they talked about the entire focus was this brain drain, if you will. College students would graduate college and they would leave Louisiana for better opportunities, better wages, better living conditions, you know, whatever it happened to be. And I was certainly guilty of that. Now, my industry, Hollywood, Los Angeles, filmmaking and television, is out here. I guess if I worked in the oil field industry, I would either be in Dubai or New Orleans. So now you're talking about December 2008, the start of the Great Recession into 2009, and college students are getting out of school and they're not getting any jobs because the unemployment is just skyrocketing. And I think what happened was is that all of a sudden a bubble got created, And this perfect storm, pun intended, gets created where now you have these college students that have these digital skills, they have these computer skills, that they can't go anyplace because nobody is hiring. So now you have these graduates that are trying to take these skills and implement them. And, you know, they've got this degree and they've got all this, you know, training and everything, and they want to put it to work. Well, how are they going to put it to work? So the state legislature broadens these tax incentives not only to include just game and digital, but all digital media types of startups. So you have these companies come to town and they want to set up shop, whether it's animation, whether it's computer gaming, whatever it happens to be. And they need talent. Well, the talent happened to be there. Now, when I say talent, I mean people that have the skill to be able to take entry-level jobs and get into it, because it is a skill. You just can't walk in and do a game or digital animation or any kind of computer-generated imagery without some kind of training. And a lot of students nowadays are getting that by going to college or going to these technical trade schools. And so now all of a sudden, I think what happened is there was a freeze, if you will, because the economy was tanking and you have all these college students that can't go anywhere because there are no jobs, their unemployment rate is skyrocketing, they're having to stay closer to home. Now some of these opportunities are opening up. So flash forward, it's 2012. You have other companies that are coming in, and then you have people who are starting up their own small digital media companies. And I'm talking small. I'm either talking the owner and maybe one or two other people, or just the owner, that are starting up these companies and trying something. And I think that's where the entire impetus was. When the legislature opened up those tax incentives, the companies started coming in, and there was sort of that freeze, that contraction of college student talent that didn't leave. Next thing you know, Forbes does a study about this brain gain coming to New Orleans. It started to catch on. It started to catch fire, if you will. Now, let's bring this around into a big picture. In Silicon Valley in California, they work in their bubble. If you want to work in that sector, then you move up to Silicon Valley. And in Los Angeles, they're trying to fight that kind of meme, if you will, that if you're going to be in that sector, you have to go to Silicon Valley. And in Los Angeles, they're creating these groups and startups to say, hey, we have the same kind of talent in Los Angeles. You don't have to go all the way up to Silicon Valley. Well, here's the thing. I don't think Silicon Valley or Los Angeles have any clue of the kind of capabilities that New Orleans and Southeast Louisiana have when it comes to digital media opportunities. Looking back at the digital domain failure, it would have been great, of course, had Digital Domain not filed for bankruptcy, had they had come to Louisiana and set up shop, because that would have created more economic activity. There would have been more jobs, and a lot of that brain drain, I think, would have contracted and stayed home and had that ability to take advantage of that. Whereas because of the Great Depression, that they weren't able to leave to go to other jobs, that doesn't solve any problem. But there was that contraction of talent that stayed home. And in that respect, I think this perfect storm with these tax incentives and that contraction helped fuel this industry. I think it was just basically a rule of unintended consequences. But in the end, Louisiana is the winner. And it is perfectly clear to me that none of this would have happened were it not for the success of the film and television tax incentives that Louisiana had rolled out. Look at where they're at now. Louisiana is number 3 in production revenue behind New York and California, respectively, and doing great. And I don't see why this can't continue growing for the long term. And when I say long term, for the next 5 to 10 years, and then reevaluate where this economy is going when it comes to Louisiana and its entertainment structure. So there you go. That's a little bit on what Fast Company had talked about with regards to this brain gain. This year's New Orleans Film Festival is October 11th through the 18th, and they're going to show some films at the newly renovated Joy Theater. The last time I was in the Joy Theater, it was just a dump, and I really, to this day, never thought it would get back to the point it is. In my opinion, it was a miracle. The last film I saw there was Jaws when I was a teenager. And then the last time I was actually inside that theater was for shooting a film, and the theater was just horrible. With the premieres and screenings and the relaunch of the Joy Theater, the New Orleans Film Festival is taking advantage of that and showing a documentary there on the 14th. After a Herculean effort mounted by producer and director Krista Rock with her wonderful production team, the NOLA Bound documentary will premiere on October 14th, Sunday, at 7 p.m. at the Joy Theater. I was involved with the NOLA Bound doc. Backing up, I was one of 27 people selected by the BeNOLABound.com organization to come to New Orleans and give our input. I was one of 27 lucky selected individuals, and we were brought to New Orleans to give our view on our own individual business sectors of what we thought New Orleans had to offer to the world when it comes to business. In my sector, it happened to be entertainment, arts-based film and television. Now, I haven't seen the documentary yet, but there's going to be a big red carpet premiere at that Joy Theater. It lasts about an hour. There are going to be some of the NOLA Bound participants there. All the information about the NOLA Bound documentary and the NOLA Film Festival will be posted on the website, thehollywoodsouthblog.com. All the show notes will be there, so don't worry. If you miss it, if you're out jogging, if you're out doing something else, when you get back home, you can log on to the computer, get to thehollywoodsouthblog.com, and the show notes will be there. So we hope to see you guys out there. Now let's talk about a good subject, indie film scene in New Orleans. Every time I come back to New Orleans and I talk to local filmmakers, everyone from producers to directors to writers to crew talent to even actors, the number one complaint that they have is the independent filmmaking scene, the indigenous filmmaking scene, the independent filmmaking scene of Louisiana, Shreveport, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Lafayette, the other cities, is sort of fractured. The only kinds of projects that are coming out are either college projects or they're short films that groups get together and they work on to produce. So this argument always returns me to the days of people asking, well, how does a film get made? That's such a broad question that you could spend an entire college course, an entire 4 years in college trying to understand to 30 seconds and telling somebody how a film gets made. Now, the kinds of films that I see come out of Louisiana's indigenous independent filmmaking community, indie community, if you will, are one of two varieties. Either they're short films that somebody is trying to do just to either practice the craft, or it's an effort to actually produce a film to get it submitted into a film festival or a film competition. So those are the two kinds of varieties. I haven't seen anybody yet come up with a feature film, if you will, who would sit down and try to get that thing financed, get it produced, and get it distributed. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, because obviously it has happened. But those are the two types of varieties of people had asked me. In fact, I've been asked several times, well, when are you coming to New Orleans, coming back home to produce your projects? Well, this starts contracting that whole question about how is a movie made? Well, the first thing is that you need to be able to have financial backers. Those financial backers can be anybody from your Aunt May to a bank to an oil sheik in Saudi Arabia. Those are the kinds of broad financial backers that you can have, business partners. I remember a long, long, long time ago, I was at a convention in Los Angeles, and I was sitting in on a film finance kind of seminar, and I was listening to this well-known guru stand up there and talk about how you don't have to go to film school to learn to make films, and you don't have to go to college. And part of that is right. I did go to film school, I did go to college, and at the same time I worked in the industry. So I guess I was very fortunate. I got the best of both worlds. And somebody finally stood up in the back of this seminar and screamed at the top of his lungs, "Well, where do we go to get the money?" And the guy says, "Well, you can go to your uncle and ask your uncle if he's got the money." And that guy got so upset, he just stormed out of the room. And as soon as he left, and the door sort of slammed, this instructor, if you will, or the speaker, had stood up there and said, "Listen, whoever is willing to back your project, that becomes your business partner. Does your Aunt May know anything about making films? No. Does your college buddy, who happens to be a millionaire who sold oil field widgets and made a lot of money, know how to make films? Probably not. Does some oil sheik in Saudi Arabia know how to make films? Probably not. If you're going to produce in the indie film scene in Louisiana, in my opinion, the first thing you have to start off of is you have to develop business partners that are willing to go down that road with you. They either finance or back your business. The second part of it is that you need to be able to understand Louisiana's film and television tax incentives, because I don't see somebody shooting in Louisiana or developing a project in Louisiana and not shooting in Louisiana, going to some other state. Now, in the show number one, I had talked about, if I remember correctly, I had talked about some projects that I had in development. Some are short-time development, some have been in development for a long time. And there's only one project that I have that absolutely has to be shot in Hollywood, because the story is about the characters and their experiences in Hollywood, two actresses coming to Hollywood and their experiences. So you would have to shoot it there. Every other script that I have that's optioned that I'm looking at can be changed and configured to shoot in Louisiana, with maybe some scenes filmed, like one of them, I have to film some scenes in New York. Not a problem. That's part of the making that whole imaginary world come to life. The third thing of it is understanding the actual process of running a production company. I think that's the big problem, is a lot of people can go out with their credit card and buy $5,000 worth of gear and go out and start shooting and editing and putting something together, and nobody wants to watch it, nobody wants to buy it when it comes to a business venture, but they show it to their friends. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever. The way I look at it is that you're either going to look at your filmmaking career as a hobby, or you're going to look at it as a business. Can you sustain yourself in that hobby? Sure, you can shoot and do your productions as many as you want over your career. Maybe one takes off. Maybe you submit it to film festivals and win some awards. That's absolutely great. But if you're going to make a business out of it, then you have to sit down just like any other business person would, whether they're going to have a digital startup, like I talked about earlier, or whether they're going to sell t-shirts in the French Quarter or sell beignets on the sidewalk. You're going to have to come up with some kind of business plan and approach. I'm not going to sell beignets on the sidewalk or sell t-shirts in the French Quarter because I don't know how to do that. Could I learn? Sure, but that's not my area of expertise. So going back to trying to whittle down these arguments that I hear, I ask people point blank, do you want to do this for a living, or do you want to do this as a hobby? And 99.9% of them say, "Oh, I want to do it for a living. I want to make money." And I said, "How much are you willing to invest in your time and money to make this happen?" And they said, "Oh, everything." "What do you do now to support yourself?" "Well, I work as this." Okay, so the only time you could really do your films are on the weekends or at nights, or if you work at nights during the day. Maybe you're doing a short film and it takes you a year to produce because you have to shoot on the weekends. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't know how many films I've done over my career have either helped out, worked on, donated my time, that's all we did was shoot on the weekends. If you're going to do that, that's fine. However, it's going to take a long, involved process of your time, and you're probably going to spend more of your time than you would money making those kinds of projects. Now, I'm sort of curtailing this conversation right now more in the respect of independent filmmakers, producers, writers, directors. If you're crew talent and you are a chief lighting technician, you're a grip, you're an electrician, or you're an assistant cameraman, hairstylist, makeup artist, you're going to rely upon jobs from projects that come to Louisiana and you try to get hired on. If the independent or indigenous filmmaking community of Louisiana grows, that's just going to provide more opportunities for crew talent to book themselves. It's sort of the chicken and the egg. Is Louisiana going to be stuck? All they're going to be able to do is bring in these large productions or medium-large productions, small productions. They're going to shoot and leave to go elsewhere. Only time is going to tell. So long as the film and television tax incentives stay and the productions keep coming and the crew talent grows, I think it's going to start really digging itself in to the point where it would be totally a disaster to pull that out or not provide those incentives. So going back to an independent filmmaker, you're thinking, well, I shoot on the weekends, I get my friends together and we go shoot projects and I'm trying to do something with it, but I don't know what I'm doing. I'd like to make a film, or I wrote a script. Zombies and horror movies seem to be the script du jour, if you will, the film du jour. And back early in my career, that's all I worked on were horror films, hacker slasher kinds of movies. And I don't know how many gallons of Karo syrup and red dye number 5 I have trudged through, which is stage blood, if you will, for those that don't know, that you would create. It just gets splattered all over everything when you're doing a horror film. I never thought in a million years that would come back to life, pun intended, where now that's all you're seeing is these resurgence of zombie movies. I just find it quite comical. Had I known back then what I know now, maybe I would have stuck making zombie movies. I don't know. You're an independent filmmaker and you've got a script and you want to produce it. You're stuck and shooting on the weekends and you're having your friends trying to donate their time. And the problem is that as the weekends go by, next thing you know is some friends can't make it because they have their own lives. And then the film slows down and you can't get any production done. All of a sudden your interest starts waning and you realize I'm not going to get this thing finished. I've only got 15 minutes done of the film and it's going to, at this rate, it's going to take me 15 years to do. Well, my advice is don't bite off more than you can chew. The number one problem that I see with independent filmmakers right out of the gate is they want to shoot a feature film. They think that when they write this feature script and they shoot it, that that's going to be some project that they can turn around and sell and try to make money. I am the first to tell you that never ever take no for an answer from anybody, and I'm not telling you can't do it by any stretch of the imagination. However, I get asked this question all the time in Louisiana, in New Orleans, in Baton Rouge, in the cities that I visit when I come back, about the independent filmmaking community. Well, how can we get this indigenous community going outside of doing these short little films? Well, I think that's what you need to do, is you need to be able to create a portfolio of work of short films that you can use as a portfolio to start a production company and go around. And if you want to do a feature, then you're going to have to hire a producer, somebody knows what they're going to do in producing a feature, or you're going to have to turn around and learn really hard how to get those films produced. That's usually the first thing you need to do, because when you're going to sit down with somebody, your Aunt May or your buddy from high school that made it rich by selling oil field widgets, and explain to them, listen, I want you to invest $500,000 into this film, and I'm not sure if I can get you your money back, then I don't see how you're going to get anybody to invest in your film unless you try to get that money cobbled from families and friends. And in the end, if you have a failure, then how are you going to live with your family and friends? The way I look at it is that the advice that I've always given people is that start off and make short films. Make a 5 to 7 minute film. No, maybe not something no longer than 10 minutes and practice your craft. Because if this is the first time you shot with a camera, first time you've edited, first time you've lit a scene, first time you've worked with actors, you're not going to get it right out of the gate. Because your parents, your family, your friends are going to love your film. Hey, that's great. But they're never going to tell you the truth that your project sucks. And trust me, that's all I hear in Hollywood. Every single project sucks. I'm not saying your project's going to suck. I'm just saying if you're going to start trying to do feature films, in my opinion, the best thing to do is start off and do shorts. Once you get those shorts done, then you're going to be able to have a portfolio to show prospective business partners. And if you can't find, you're not going to be able to go to a window that says, oh, I'm going to go to window C, and at window C is where the film financing is. And it said, yes, I have this $500,000 film I would like someone to invest in, and I've done all these shorts. Can you take a look at them? Generally speaking, that's not the way it works. The way it works is that you're going to get business partners from all walks of life. That's just the way it is. You read these stories in the trades about these production companies that get these lines of credit and get these financing utilities of $300 million. And so you think, wow, they got $300 million sitting in the bank. How many films can they make out of that? And you dream to yourself, that will never happen. Well, if you're an independent filmmaker, nothing is impossible. That's generally the advice that I give people. If you really want to become an independent filmmaker, and when I'm talking about independent filmmaker, let's talk about feature film kind of leaning, your dramatic, fictional kinds of pieces, not documentary. I'll speak to documentary in a second. If you're going to do something like that, my first advice is you need to come up with a small portfolio of 7 to 10 minute films. Now, you may not use the same cameraman, you may not use the same actors, the same hairstylist or something like that, but if you're going to be the director, producer, or if you're going to be the writer, director, or director, actor, writer, then you're going to have to be able to show something for that. A lot of projects today, even in television, they're not even financing the pilots anymore. They're going straight to episode one and ordering. Granted, they're doing that with proven producers and proven executive producers that can put those stories together. I'm just talking about indie film scene. So that's my advice that I usually give to independent filmmakers that start out, is that start off with a small portfolio. And the best part is that you can practically do all your distribution for free. You can distribute it on DVDs, you can distribute it on pay-per-view, you can distribute it on YouTube. There's a million different ways, opportunities for you to distribute product. You can sit in your room all you want with that camera and think things up, or you know, sit at your computer writing a script, and none of that matters until you actually get a short film completed. And what I mean by short film completed is something to show somebody else. I'll take myself for example. I have a couple scripts that I've been working on for a short period of time, and then I have one script that I've been working on that I think to myself, I don't know if this thing will ever get produced. And if it's going to get produced, it's going to get produced by me. Never give up on your vision and your opportunities that you have that come your way. You're going to have people, for instance, you'll have a cameraman who owns a camera and maybe owns some lights, and you get together with them and say, hey, I've got this script I'd like to direct. Let's get some actors together and do this little short film. Then you've developed a little partnership there. Technically, you're doing it for a hobby, but maybe in the end game, what you're doing is that you're trying to provide a portfolio for everybody. Not only will you get a short film for yourself, the cameraman or camerawoman will get a short film for themselves. The actors get that opportunity. But if you're going to go out and shoot some stuff and you're not going to put it together for a year or two, then you're not going to get anybody to work with you anymore because they believed in you and thought, well, let's do this short film, and it never gets completed and I have nothing to show for my work. I'm willing to act for free. I'm willing to shoot for free. I'm willing to edit this for free so long as I get some kind of work product out of that. Maybe there's not one exact answer for learning to be an independent filmmaker, and I'm talking about the indigenous filmmaking community in Louisiana, and this could go for any state or any population, if you will. But from my professional experience, that's generally what I have found that works. If that's the kind of career you want to go into and that's the direction you want to go, then I think that's where you should first start off. Because along the way, let's say you decide, man, I just don't want to be a director. I'm just going to go back to be a makeup artist, or I'm going to go continue doing props in the filmmaking community, or maybe I'll do a film here and there. That's one thing. And I understand that. A lot of people have done that. And there's no shame in that. There's no failure in that. You tried something and gone in that direction. I came to Hollywood to be a cinematographer, to be a director of photography, a cameraman, and I absolutely enjoyed everything that I did. I remember sitting on the set one time, and a two-time Emmy-winning DP had leaned over to his girlfriend and said, man, my agents have got to get me some work because I've got this mortgage to pay. And he lived in $1 million home, and this is, what, 20-some-odd years ago. And I thought to myself, wow, I've got another 25 years just to get to his point to complain about my agent getting me work as a DP. And as my career progressed, I came out of shooting and through production and post-production, ended up in the chair I am today as a producer, from commercials to features to shorts, those kinds of things. And I realized there wasn't any shame or there wasn't any failure of being starting off to be a cameraman, and that changes. The old adage is, but what I really want to do is direct. In fact, I think I've seen a million different versions of that on t-shirts. What I'm saying is that when you start putting together your project, that may come to fruition. You may find out, you know what, you like writing better than you like directing. You just don't want to hassle it. So write more. As you learn your craft, you're going to learn to be able to work with actors and other people, the crew talent, to put together your short. In the big picture, that's the first thing you're going to have to do if you want to be that kind of independent filmmaker. I talked earlier about documentary filmmaking, nonfiction. Now, that's different. If you're going to be a documentary filmmaker, which on one hand, talking to a lot of documentary filmmakers, I just do not see how there's any money in that. A lot of people are documentary filmmakers and they do quite well, and that's good for them. But you can shoot a documentary film over a couple of years, over a couple of 10 or 15 years, or you could shoot a documentary film in a few weeks. The common denominator that I see between documentary filmmaking, nonfiction, and fiction is the narrative storyline. You're going to be able to tell some kind of story. If you're going to be an independent filmmaker in Louisiana, in my opinion, that's what you should start off, is try to be able to create a small portfolio of projects that you can show to prospective business investors, because you're going to eventually have to go out and look for somebody to invest in your projects. I don't think this is a singular kind of person venture, if you will, meaning that I don't see it as somebody who has this wonderful script and they're just going to do everything themselves and they're looking for the money. Develop business relationships with people. Sit down with somebody. Say somebody doesn't want to write. Somebody just wants to direct, or somebody wants to be the producer, or somebody wants to shoot, and that's all they want to do. They don't want to be involved in the writing or the editing or whatever. Develop a small core of people and put together an agreement between everybody to say, hey, this is what we want to do in this production company. You're going to produce, you're going to direct, and then next project we'll swap. You direct and I produce. In my opinion, to be able to get that kind of business going, you're going to have some kind of portfolio to show for it. In a big, long, roundabout way, how much does it take to make a film? The question asked, and the complaints that I hear, well, there's the independent filmmaking scene, there's nothing happening here, and I'm getting tired of working for free because there's nothing coming out of it. Well, then move on and work with people that you find are talented and deliver on their words and are delivering those portfolios, those projects that you work on, whether you're acting, doing special effects, shooting, or editing, writing, whatever, that you can put in your own portfolio. Maybe you do a couple of films with them and you find out, well, this isn't a group that I want to work with, but I've developed enough portfolio of my own that I want to go off and do something for myself. I don't know how many times I've seen people say, well, apparently I'm an overnight success. It just took me 30 years to make that happen. Look at the writer who won the Oscar for King's Speech. He's in his mid-60s, and all he said was, man, please keep hiring people of our age. And in my opinion, age has nothing to do with it. This is one of the few industries where you can hire anybody of any age, and there's a spot for them. So not trying to get sidetracked, but that's the way I see it. Try to develop relationships with people that you want to go and work with, and relationships to develop a portfolio. And my own road to success, if you will, in my career led that down that way. I came out to be a cameraman, and I worked a lot of positions on crews, but I eventually ended up producing. And I love it, but I also love shooting too, which I still do to this day. So there you go. That's my take on the indie film scene in Louisiana and New Orleans. Team up with a good portfolio of people, create a good portfolio, and at the end of the day, you'll have a nice portfolio to show prospective business partners, because you're going to have to go to somebody and try to convince them to invest in your project. Don't start off trying to make a feature film. It's just too much of a beast to start off in the beginning. Start off with shorts, because I think that is where the industry is heading. You've got a lot of short films that are out there. Now, granted, you may get lost in the shuffle, but it's up to you to try to use your marketing skills and your production efforts to get the word out. Hey, this is what we've done. Take a look at this. And you may do half a dozen films, and they may be 7 to 10 minutes long, but you've made zero money off of them. The thing is that you've created intellectual property. You've created this portfolio with your business partners. And when I say business partners, not necessarily money, if you will, to put together work that everybody can be proud of. I have found that the people you start off working with aren't the people you cross the finish line with. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of this show. I just want to let everybody know that if you're jogging, working out, or working in the yard, or driving in the car, and you're listening to this, don't worry. I put extensive show notes on the website, thehollywoodsouthblog.com. You can go there, click on links of things that I've discussed, and try to expound on something that I didn't talk about today. And there will be links there for articles that I didn't go too much in depth for, but at least you could go back and read those articles. Also on the website are free crew listings. If you're a crew talent and you want to be listed, go to hollywoodsouthblog.com and you can find a form there to fill out for free crew listings. If you work with 15 different crew titles or whatever it happens to be, go ahead and fill out all 15 of them. You just have to fill out one form at a time. There is the Hollywood South Blacklist group that I have created that I have seen work in California and in New York. And what it is a message board group where, let's say, you're an independent filmmaker and you need somebody that has editing equipment, you need a cameraman, or you need a device on how to shoot a location with the proper release, and you just don't know what to do. You can post a question on that group, and in that group, as it grows and it's just starting off, you're going to have people that give their opinions and help. So think of it as a collective conscience. Instead of you sitting there thinking or on location thinking, God, what should I fill out this form? Do I have this release? Well, I had this actor in a scene, but for some reason, everybody forgot to get a release from her. What should I do? Those are kinds of questions that you can post. It's the Hollywood South Blacklist group. Go to the website and you can sign up. All of this is for free. And you'll get on the list and put your questions up there. And you never know. You may not get the answer you're looking for, or at least allows you to think about questions. And it's a good way to network with the community. Let's see, what else? Oh, another thing, music submissions. If you happen to be a composer, because listen, music composers are part of the filmmaking entertainment community, or you know somebody that's a composer, or you know a band that has a great CD, send an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com and send links to the music. We'll put them on a show and premiere them, because I would like to promote as many talented people as I can on this show. My career has been very good to me, and I want to try to take this opportunity in using this podcast and the website, thehollywoodsouthblog.com, to help out as many people as I can. Well, everybody, thanks for joining me on the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we've tried to discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, like I said, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com. And be sure to stop by the website to take a look around. We'll have all the show notes and links we discussed on the show. This is Stan Gill for the Hollywood South Blacklist. Thanks for listening.